Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is Saturday, October 29th, 2011. And I'll bring my co-host on right away, is James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Jim, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Chris?
Okay. The weather's turned a little cooler these days.
Yeah. Getting there.
Yeah. I want to thank you, Jim. I've been reading that book, Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience. Have you read that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. It's in ways, it's much of traditional material, but he does pull it together nicely and has a very he emphasizes more than other people do how science is unable to account for consciousness.
Yes, I think you know their research group had done not just a retrospective study but a long term study and had published in the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, which is the equivalent of the American Medical Association journal, the most prestigious medical journal in the UK. And as you say, I think he has something of a bigger picture of how enigmatic and mysterious this phenomenon actually is, and I think really sort of grasps the paradigm shifting implications that this requires. And he talks about the non-local explanation of consciousness, and he talks about a number of things that really challenge what you would term the head doctrine, and I think even at times he alludes. It's interesting because he's a cardiologist, a very prominent Dutch cardiologist, the author Dr. Van Lommel, Pim Van Lommel, alludes to. I think he'd be very interested in your work. He alludes to the importance of the heart and also the mystery. At one point, he talks about something that I've talked about several times in this program, about the mystery of the enduring stability of the human body, even though it's in constant flux, and the idea that the limitations of material explanations and really addressing the complexity of life and the continuity of the physical body. I think it's really interesting what he says about that. How much of your book have you actually read?
Just over halfway through.
It's a very important book, though, I think, because I, as you say, if you know that literature, you're not going to be shocked by anything that he says in it, really, but he does pull it together nicely.
Yeah. Here's one quote from him. He says, the hypothesis that consciousness and memory are produced and stored exclusively in the brain remains unproven.
Yeah.
There is no direct evidence to prove if and how neurons in the brain produce the subjective essence of our consciousness.
Yeah.
Very
important.
Yeah, it's funny how I call it the head doctrine or the head dogma, I call it sometimes, because this has been the main view in psychology for the past century, that somehow the brain produces consciousness and mind, and it's centered in the head. I haven't seen him suggest that consciousness is related to the heart, though. And he also, it's interesting how much they focus on the blood flow in the body and kind of studying blood flow. And he never seems to consider that maybe consciousness might be connected to blood flow. That just odd elements a little bit. It's an interesting book. I'll comment more on it when I finish it up in the next show. I'll be through it.
Yeah,
I think we had said, Jim, previously, we keep saying that we're going to go into Beelzebub's tales and talk about, like, the causes of war. And so we should maybe really try to do follow through on that today, because I think we've put it off for about 3 to 4 months now. Do you have your copy of The Slugs handy?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, in a way, I've been reluctant to do it because it's a lot of reading in a way. But I thought that we've never really read selections from Beelzebub's tales. I mean, we use some of Gurdjieff's quotes and references, but we've not really given a sampling of the manner in which he writes and such. So I thought maybe today we'll try to go through some of the material from The Slugs, and maybe as we go along, at times you agreed selections as well, and we can just coordinate it. We both have a copy of the book here. Okay, does that sound good?
Yeah, I just... I hope we can discuss von Lommel's book in the next program or the program after. Just he's talking about new perspectives on consciousness and the brain. He says the brain and the body merely function as a relay station, receiving part of the overall consciousness and part of our memories in our waking consciousness in the form of measurable and constantly changing electromagnetic fields. In this view, these electromagnetic fields of the brain are not the cause, but rather the effect or consequence of endless consciousness. And he has various quotes where he talks about, like, the non-local aspects of consciousness. And so I think he's kind of really primed, actually, to be very receptive to the position that you're articulating and that you've, you know, created. I think he'd be very interested in what you're arguing about the heart doctrine.
Yeah, I should really send him a copy of my
book. I really think you should, because I think, as I say, I think he's kind of there, but he's not there. But he would certainly not dismiss it. I know that, and I think he would actually be quite fascinated, especially because, as I say, he is a cardiologist, you know. So it's you know, he's certainly receptive and seems to understand the implications of he more than understands the implications. He outright says that these things, consciousness and life, aren't really reducible to the physiological structures in the body and the processes in the body, but that there are non-local causes beyond which are more primary, which are somehow manifesting on the material plane. Like, he doesn't quite say it in those terms, but he does say it. Like, that's very interesting. As I said, we can return to this in a future program when you've read the whole book. But I think it's a very, very important book. And I said before, I think this whole area of research is one of the more compelling reasons to reject the materialist paradigm. I think it's a body of work which is just so important, like, in terms of its implications for how we approach the study of consciousness and life. And I think it just really, really reveals and unexpectedly in terms of a materialist perspective, the limits of the materialist perspective. Like, nobody would predict that consciousness, from a materialist perspective, would predict that consciousness could in any way survive the death of the physical body. Like, when the metabolic processes of the body stop, when the brain flatlines and there's no brain activity, when the heart stops and there's no pumping and circulation of the blood, that should be the end of all experience. But this literature is very clear that that's not the case, and you know, that people, that's the first part. And then the second part is that people, when revived, have these compelling and really absolutely fascinating explanations of what has happened to them and to their consciousness when they're supposedly dead. And it's like, there's a whole transformative, transcendent aspect of that explanation, but it just the fact that people have any experience basically invalidates the comprehensiveness of the materialist perspective. At least that's the way I see it. I just see this as being such important evidence challenging the conventional wisdom on everything about life and consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it suggest that there's scientific evidence that we are multidimensional beings and that we have other bodies or vehicles that can exist within other planes of existence. I mean, it's absolutely profound. You know, a very different view than you just live and die with your body, which is where material science leads. But the fact that there's, and the near-death experience, like as you say, I agree that it provides the best evidences of our multidimensional nature, because these accounts are too consistent and lucid, and we find them from around the world and throughout history, similar accounts of out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. And then they have elements in the stories that can be objectively verified, and he gives examples of that in his book.
Out of body perspectives and observations that can be verified.
There was a case in the book where a guy, they took his, he was unconscious and going through this trauma, and they took his dentures out, and they put him on a particular place. And then days later, when he's in the recovery room, he kind of grabbed the they needed to find his dentures, and he told them where they had put them.
Yeah.
For that example, yeah, that was a really good example. It's like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's example, where a patient reported there was a running shoe on the window ledge.
Right.
Five levels. Floors above him at the hospital, that somehow there was a running shoe. He had seen this when he was out of his body, and people made the effort, and lo and behold, there was such a running shoe. You know, different examples of this, that people there's evidences that their reports are veridical observations. But it is also profound, and it just shows you, like, this is like the most profound mystery in modern psychology and science, is what is the nature of human consciousness. Like, you just see that science really has no understanding. They offer more what some people call promissory science, that we don't know the answer yet, but we promise you that, you know, it's somehow the brain is producing consciousness. And that's supposed to kind of resolve it, but the questions are really so much more deeper and complex. And to me, it's astounding now that just by being aware of the nature of consciousness in myself, because I think through our studies, through our life, like most people who study consciousness, they study it in a theoretical way or as applied to other people, but they don't have a way of studying consciousness within themselves, try to understand it within themselves. And that's what's provided by the Gurdjieff teaching in a more coherent and systematic way than any other teaching I've been exposed to. So I study consciousness in myself. And it's so self-evident to me in my own inner experience that my consciousness isn't just up in my head. Like, because that's not how I experience myself. I can experience my consciousness through my whole body. That's how I experience myself. You know, and there's no reason to think, even if you think consciousness is produced by neurological activity, well, there's neurological activity all through the body, too. It's not just all neurological activity isn't all just in the head. And the heart has its own neurological system. So if you think that neurology of the brain is producing consciousness, well, why could the neurology of the heart not be producing consciousness? You know, there's no reason to assume it's just in the brain. And then they have no idea what part of the brain produces consciousness. And it all makes so much sense that all these scientists all think consciousness is up in the head because they use their mind to study consciousness. And so they have a mental approach to understanding it. And when you understand it with your mind, and then you think it's in the mind. But I think it's clearly self-evident through basic self-observation and awareness exercises that your consciousness, we don't experience ourselves as our consciousness all up in our head. It's just not how people experience themselves in the inner world. It makes much more sense to think that consciousness can be throughout the body, and I think related to the blood flow, and also the blood flow in the subtle body. Like Gurdjieff talked about the Kesjan body, the astral body, and the blood, he says the astral body has its own blood, which he calls Handblidzorn, I think is his term for it. So it has its own, like, vital energy or vital material equivalent to blood. So there's like a blood of the astral body and there's a blood of the mental body. And it's these energies that support consciousness within the body. And it all makes so much sense. Like, you know, you study the chakras and after a while you can discern them and you can be aware of the different chakras. You know, so the consciousness isn't just up in the sixth and seventh chakra in the head. You know, the consciousness is manifest through all, or can be aware of activity of all the chakras. So I think the more and more I kind of see the head doctrine, it's just so increasingly self-evident to me how kind of foolish this has been. And it is an excellent book for that reason. And, I kind of lost myself now. What was that? I'm saying about how consciousness through self-study, which is what we learned to do with the Gurdjieff teaching. And you try to understand that Gurdjieff's main teaching is that people aren't properly conscious. Okay, they only know the level of relative consciousness or what he calls waking sleep. And they don't really experience what he calls the state of self-consciousness. But in life, everybody thinks they already have self-consciousness. But from the Gurdjieff perspective, people's normal self-consciousness is not really self-consciousness because it's structured around personality and false personality in people. So it's really their egoic nature rather than their true self. So Gurdjieff is trying to help people how to struggle to attain the state of self-consciousness. And that state in Gurdjieff is connected, he says, to the awakening of the higher emotional center. And so again, if you think the higher emotional center, we'd connect to the heart, or I would connect to the heart. And in Beelzebub's Tales, he has an interesting passage at one point when Beelzebub's talking to his grandson. And he says that the three-brained beings on planet Earth used to have their emotional center in the same place as we have it, meaning Beelzebub and his grandson. And he said that is an independent brain in the region of the breast, which I would take to mean the heart. So in Beelzebub is saying that Beelzebub and his grandson, their emotional center is connected to the heart, I would say. And he says human beings, they used to have their emotional center centered in the heart, but then it was displaced into the complex of nodes of the autonomic nervous system, particularly the pit of the stomach, which is the solar plexus he's referring to. So what Gurdjieff says in the tales is that human beings, our emotional center used to be the heart, but then it was dispersed through the autonomic nervous system. And so I tend to see, the way I understand Gurdjieff is the state of self-consciousness involves this higher level of the emotional functioning, which is the regaining of the heart-centeredness. And I think that's a very important little episode in the Beelzebub's Tales, like comment that Gurdjieff has about the heart, how the emotional center was displaced. I'm not sure what I was trying to come to here. Oh, yeah. So I was saying about the state of self-consciousness then. It makes so much sense. It has to do with the awakening of the human heart. And that it ties in so perfectly then with, like, yogis like Ramana Maharshi, who suggests, he says, self-realization involves the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So he's saying that there's a false consciousness system centered in the mind, in the head, in the false personality and ego, and the true self is said to be under our noses all the time. So it's connected with experiencing ourselves at this deeper level in the heart and becoming established in that consciousness of the heart. And the consciousness of the heart then is it illuminates ourselves, within ourselves, can illuminate different centers. So I think the mystical perspective provides such a possible comprehensive framework for trying to understand what consciousness is. It's a shame that scientists like this cardiologist, it's a shame they're not studied in certain aspects of the esoteric tradition. He has some nice quotes, though. He does quote from the Upanishads and and the Egyptian Book of the Dead. He does drop some parallels to mystical literature. But anyway, so I think it's very important, this concept. If I had to say what is the basic teaching of the Heart Doctrine book, is that we have to try to awaken or attain this heart consciousness, and that the true self or the deepest level of self is connected to the physics of the heart. There's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart, a holographic physics at that. So it's an amazing concept of, you know, what we could be, or what I would say what we are as beings. It's such an alternative model of the nature and structure of existence. And it's really inspired. I would prefer to have multidimensional existence in life. I would take a fancy to that, you know. I'd like to travel in the astral world and go to the halls of learning and learn about, like, the true history of the planet and evolution and all these higher mysteries. And, you know, over time, I think all these things might be revealed. I mean, it's wonderful. It's such a dreary little concept, really, that we're just animals. You live and you die with your body, and that's it. And you have no soul, and there's no spirit, and there's no God. And I mean, if it were true, then we'd need to face that. But in a way, it's this kind of completely superficial pseudo-scientific philosophy that's been attached onto the facts of science. It's much more interesting to, I'll myself prefer the life in the multidimensional universe. I'd much prefer that. It's interesting, Isaac Asimov, how he says, I know when I die, my eye will be lost forever. And then he says that he can't imagine kind of flying around in heaven. He'd just prefer his nothingness. He makes that comment, I just prefer my nothingness. So I think, you know, Isaac Asimov may have his little heart's desire satisfied. He might have his nothingness. But I'm just being smart a bit. But it's amazing to think, to have a model of multidimensional existence. And in my view, the study of this area of 40 years, I think there's overwhelming scientific evidence supportive of these kinds of concepts. It doesn't mean we understand how it all works. It just raises all kinds of other questions. But it does raise all kinds of other questions that can be approached scientifically. So yeah, so it's been because it's interesting when we've got back to talking about near death experiences, and that's what I was into 30 years ago when I studied that literature, and I was a professor at the time, and I felt it was so important at that time. But then what my approach was, at a certain point, I reached a conclusion that I wanted to assume that there's validity to this. So then I became interested not in trying to prove there's something to the existence of these phenomena, but instead I asked, how could it work? Because if these things, if we're multidimensional beings, then there has to be a higher dimensional physics to how it works. So how could that possibly work? And I think through my 40 years of striving in that direction, like I think I've developed some pretty sophisticated answers as possible kind of model or ideas to give us some guidance in those directions. To me, it's a pretty profound idea. You know, the last article I did in that series in the Esoteric Studies Journal was called An Alternate Model of the Higher Dimensional Structure of Human Existence. And I just love that title. And that's exactly what it is, because in a way, what I'm suggesting is that a human being has like a monadic essence or a God spark. And this element exists in like hyperspace or higher dimensional space. And in my work, I explain how this could be like a little mini black hole processor in physics, where they're developing the concept in the holographic model of physics. That's the way, if you can have a black hole in higher dimensional space, its activities are rendered equivalent to material and energetic processes within the four-dimensional space-time. So there could be this whole higher dimensional structure, inward structure to human existence, where we could have this monad in hyperspace, and then that element is surrounded by different bodies, which are vehicles for awareness on different planes of existence. And I know my work is like consistent with the esoteric traditions, and it's based particularly on Blavatsky's secret doctrine. But I like the idea. Wouldn't you rather have multidimensional existence, Jim? Or a lot of people think to get so fed up with it all, I think they wouldn't want to come back again through such tragedies, though, in life.
Yeah, I remember one time in the X-Files, the guy said to the vampire, said to Mulder, "Wouldn't you want to live forever?" And he said, "Not if drawstring pants come back in fashion." It's like, you know, it's funny because I think you're just too weak-minded and you just want everything to be the way you want it to be, and you're not willing to face the fact that when you die, that's it, and there's no you. I mean, that's the funny thing. The more I read like skeptical responses to mystical esoteric teachings, that's what they say. It's like, you know, oh, we're the hard-headed realists. You know, kind of interesting choice of phrase. We're the hard-headed realists who are willing to face reality. You know, as it is, not as how we wish it to be, you know, there's a phrase from Sagan when he's describing mystical claims as a farrago, weak-minded promises, or something to that effect, and then there's a quote that Sagan quotes from, I think it's from Richard Feynman, when he's talking about the mystical viewpoint, and Feynman says it's just the religious and mystical viewpoints are too provincial of the nature of the universe, but I mean, they're really not. His misunderstanding of things, his mistaking fundamentalist views with the mystical views is just that there are those views are just somewhat provincial, but there's nothing provincial at all about the mystical perspective on the nature of consciousness and life. The idea that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe—it's a very profound claim. And in many ways, once you begin to really understand what it entails, it offers very coherent and lucid and elegant explanations of many of the things that we can't understand or can't explain in terms of modern science and psychology, and can't explain or understand from a materialist perspective. Like, it's clear that the materialist perspective is useful within certain limitations and very, you know, powerful tool to understand things, but it's also equally clear that it's not a comprehensive explanation of the nature of life and consciousness, and doesn't really even begin to explain either of the most, you know, the most basic phenomenon which we all witness, which is that we're alive and that we're conscious to some extent or degree. And yet those are the sort of the enduring mysteries, and not to mention the nature of the I experience. So, as you say, if you begin to try to understand a lot of these anomalous and enigmatic phenomena, such as the near-death experience, and that's just one aspect. There's all sorts of different manifestations of transcendent experiences of consciousness, then you begin to realize just there's so much more that needs to be explained here, and that really it's not, as Carl Sagan says, that as science advances, there seems to be less and less for God to do. In a way, like, the mysteries become that much more mysterious the more science advances, because in a way, we're confronted with, on the one hand, with the enormous achievements in our understanding of science, but at the same time, we're also confronted with the amazing enigmas and mysteries. I remember in 1979, there was the Scientific American issue. It was on the brain. And in one of the articles in that, we were talking about all these advances in neuroscience and everything, but somebody said in one of the articles, well, when you get right down to it, we really don't understand how one neuron works, let alone the entire brain, you know, and that's true. Like, I mean, in some very fundamental ways, we have such profound ignorance about the most basic things, and that's the flip side of scientific advances. Like, in some senses, it's a series of Chinese boxes. You open one, and there's a whole another series of nests within nests within nests, and we don't really can't really put it all together. At the beginning, I was talking about why I thought the near-death experience phenomenon and the research into it, which has been going on for about 35 years now, why it's so important. One of the reasons it's important is, like you say, because, there's different elements to it, but, I mean, it takes place, much of the literature takes place in the hospitals where there's some sort of empirical data on physiological processes that are occurring, so that you see a person that their heart monitor flatlines and their brain monitor flatlines. So you have some sort of empirical evidence that metabolic activity has ceased and brain activity has ceased, and yet people have these continuous experiences of consciousness, and then they have these higher dimensional conscious states in which they experience transcendent experiences and have these consistent experiences with what others report of these profound states of realization about the nature of themselves and the nature of the universe. And that all of that is really interesting in and of itself, but what makes it particularly compelling and particularly interesting is that it's entirely consistent with so many aspects of what is taught in the mystical and esoteric tradition about the nature of consciousness and life, the nature of how human beings are multidimensional beings, how there are multidimensional planes of reality, and that these are accessible in higher transcendent states of consciousness. This evidence is entirely inconsistent with a materialist perspective. So if you were going to make a prediction about what would happen, like if before we started really having the technology to resuscitate people that we have now, which has led to such an increase in the number of these reports, even though, as you pointed out, they've been reported throughout history. If you were to make predictions prior to this evidence, the body of evidence being accumulated, clearly the materialist perspective would have said, to somebody arguing from the materialist perspective, would have said, well, what would happen if a person was flatlining, there was no brain activity, no physiological activity, the heart had stopped, what would they experience? And the answer is simple, nothing. But from a mystical and esoteric perspective, the answer would be quite different. And guess what? You know, the predictive power of the mystical and esoteric perspective turns out to be it's not comparable. There is no predictive power in the materialist perspective. There's an entirely predictive power in the mystical and esoteric explanations, and much of what people experience is exactly what people who have had transcendent experiences, not involving near-death experiences, have predicted, have described, and have analyzed. So in that sense, that's why I think this is so interesting, because this is one of those things that's like, remember for a long time when we used to talk about this, like about transcendent states of consciousness, and trying to think of other examples in science where you can't really be there to sort of observe them like empirically, or and you can't observe them externally. It's like when meteors started falling on the Earth, and people say, well, the rock's falling from the sky, and the French Academy of Science dismissed the idea as being ludicrous. Well, it's hard to actually be there to see it happen, but you get some sort of evidence afterwards that it does happen. It's trying to piece together an explanation of what is happening. It's kind of like that with a lot of transcendent experiences of consciousness, which often occur either spontaneously or in people who aren't going to run out to the, you know, fill out a report for the psychological bulletin or the, you know, some sort of psychological journal. So, as I say, that's why I find this particular body of evidence so interesting, because it is scientific in the sense that it's something that is observed by people with scientific training, i.e. medical practitioners. And at the same time, it's been studied quite thoroughly now, and there are, like, literally, as Kubler-Ross said, you know, there's thousands of cases. After a while, if you are still wrangling with the question as to whether or not this is real, you're a bit of an idiot, you know, because that's not the question that somebody who's truly scientific would ask. They'd ask not is this happening, but how is it possible this is happening? And that's where I see sort of the avoidance mechanism and in the materialist, the rational materialists and the skeptics, is that they don't want to admit it, because if they have to admit that this is something that needs explaining, and if they can't reduce it to a lack of oxygen or any of the other what turns out to be ridiculous explanations for this phenomena, then there's something seriously wrong with their worldview, and something totally inexplicable in their worldview, which demands explanation. And it's so basic because it deals with life and consciousness, which are the two big enduring mysteries and enigmas that confront anybody who's trying to make sense of their existence. It's like, what is the nature of life? What is the nature of consciousness? And really, for all its smarts, modern science doesn't really have that much to say about these things.
No, they've avoided the subjects for a century in the mainstream of science, ever since really the Darwinian evolutionary theory and the kind of view that human beings were simply higher primates and were like other animals. They denied the vitalism, belief that there's a vital principle or a soul, that beings have souls. So we've had a long, very restricted kind of model of human existence for the past century. And there has been this ignoring of all this kind of data, like from near-death experiences, but also other scientific evidence for ESP and ghosts and out-of-body experiences, whole range of phenomena. So it is amazing how it, I mean, I think through our mystical studies, we've kind of seen how, in a way, this kind of perspective brings everything together and makes sense of it all, and does provide new ways of thinking about these very profound issues, like the issue of what is the nature of the I experience in a living being, and what is the origin, the nature of consciousness. And then connected to that, you know, do we have multidimensional existence?
You know, I wanted to, the one thing I also wanted to comment on, which was when you were talking earlier about self-study and studying consciousness within yourself in terms of the Gurdjieff perspective, and you related that to the idea that we're not properly conscious, and that we have what Gurdjieff terms relative consciousness or waking sleep, and that everybody assumes that they're self-conscious, or, you know, or they can be self-conscious at will. And what self-study in the Gurdjieff work reveals to you very quickly is that most of our our waking state consists of like this state of very low level of consciousness where we're essentially asleep and we function associatively and mechanically and with very little awareness of ourselves being here now. It's rather where everything is seen, is heard, is acted out rather than an I doing it. And Gurdjieff emphasizes the importance of trying to understand the nature of the I experience within yourself and to cultivate the I experience within yourself and to realize how normally what the I consists of is like all these different little I's, some stronger than others, but each doing its own thing and then giving way to another I, which is evoked mechanically either by an internal or an external association. There's no real continuity of the I experience, but that it's possible to acquire to cultivate it through observing yourself and attempting to what he calls remember yourself, which is to initially means just to try to be aware that I am here now, like to be present to yourself and to be more aware of yourself, to be aware of your physical body, to be aware of your emotional state, to be aware of your thinking and your intellectual activity. And there's when he was first teaching in Russia, and this is in Search of the Miraculous, and he's talking to Uspensky about consciousness, and Uspensky's well-schooled in Western philosophy and psychology, and they're speaking of consciousness. Uspensky says to Gurdjieff, well, it's generally agreed that consciousness is indefinable, and Gurdjieff's reply is that that's rubbish, that's the usual scientific sophistry. And he said there's only one thing in what you say about consciousness that's correct, is that you can know consciousness, but you can't know it typically because you don't normally possess it. And he goes on to describe how an observation of yourself, extended systematic observation of yourselves, reveals that consciousness is something that's sometimes closer and sometimes farther, and that it's altering in its intensity and its duration throughout your waking hours. And that typically, we're in the least conscious part of the spectrum, where we're at a state of what he calls waking sleep. But then he says something that's really interesting, and I think I understand it much more deeply now than I did many years ago, what she says. The problem with Western psychologists and philosophers is that they want to study consciousness where it isn't, where it doesn't exist. And I understand now what he's talking about on a whole variety of levels. Like, in a way, it's like Western philosophers and psychologists want to assume that there's two conscious states, there's sleep and there's the waking state, and when we're awake, we're conscious. And like in with reference to Gurdjieff's statement, he's saying, no, see, you're in waking sleep, you're not really in a conscious state, so you have very little consciousness when you are thinking about that, you know, oh, I'm awake, so clearly I'm conscious. And he said, you're making a very great mistake when you assume that, and that I'm self-conscious, or that I can be at will. Like, it's very easy to be self-conscious. And yet, the attempt to study consciousness in yourself quickly disabuses you of that notion. You realize, no, that's not the case at all. It's very hard to be conscious of yourself and to sustain that state. And then, like, he's also saying, people want to study consciousness where it doesn't exist. So they think about consciousness, and they think, oh, I'm conscious. And consciousness is associated with thinking, and it's associated with the processes in the brain, as you said earlier. It's like psychologists and philosophers try to reason and think about consciousness, and they end up concluding that it's in the brain. But it's ironic, because in experimental psychological literature, it's well-understood phenomena, the experimenter effect and demand characteristics in experimental research is that people often produce the results that they're looking for, or that they're deceived by some sort of element of their study which blinds them to what's really going on. And that's precisely what happens when you don't study yourself and you try to understand consciousness, is you aren't aware of all of the all of the elements that you're projecting into your understanding of consciousness by your normal waking conscious state, which is really a state of waking sleep. And then there's like they want to study it in the head, so they don't recognize that consciousness is not in the head and that it's associated with the entire physical organism, and it's associated with the physical body and the flow of blood in the physical body. But then it's also associated with these other bodies, which are higher bodies, which are stepping down and manifesting on lower levels. So there's no understanding that the consciousness we experience is coming from some sort of higher states or transcendent realms and being stepped down. So there's a variety of ways you can understand that statement. It's a very profound statement when you really start to think about it and you really have a more sophisticated understanding of the enigmas and mysteries of consciousness. Is that's the whole problem with the Western approach to studying consciousness. As long as people want to think about it and they want to reason about it and they want to philosophize about it, but they don't want to study it, and they want to study it by studying others and don't want to study themselves systematically, they'll never really begin to understand how incredibly tricky it is to study consciousness, and they'll never really have the right approach. Like, you have to study consciousness within yourself to begin to grasp what it really is.
Yeah, it's such a subtle and complex kind of process, and it really needs time. I mean, yeah, time and years of study to try to understand the issues involved.
That's really important too. Like what you're just saying, that's so important. Like, it takes a great deal of time. It doesn't sort of, you can't figure this out by thinking about it for a month or 6 months or a year. You know, you have to undertake this process for many, many years, and it's so subtle. Your understanding of it continually is developing if you attend to it, and you can integrate it with other aspects of your knowledge and your understanding of things that you have in terms of science and psychology. Like, it's just such a complex phenomenon.
Yeah. And it's such a shame. You see how there's no modern science of the soul. Because, of course, the issue of consciousness, I see, is intimately tied to the question of the existence of the human spirit and soul. Like, they're parts of the same issue.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like a mystical view. That we are ensouled by elements and forces which are of higher dimensional nature or higher planes of existence. So divine and spiritual forces take a role in fashioning the inner human being. It's very, very complex areas of study, and we've made so little progress, I think, over the last century. People don't think very broadly on the issues of consciousness. So much of what's been done has all been in the same camp of identifying consciousness and the mind only with the brain and the head. There's been no psychology of the heart or... that's another issue, how there's been no psychology of the heart.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk today, psychologists and scientists kind of think it's simply metaphor, the way we talk about the heart. Is, you know, you love someone with all your heart, your heart's broken, or something is, when you speak, it's heartfelt. And you have all these things in our language which are kind of intuitive to people's experience of themselves, because this is how people naturally talk, and in a way it has a kind of deep mystical significance to it. Like, in a way, people know intuitively some of these things. You know, people know, no one ever goes and says, "I love you with all my head." We use that example at different points. I mean, it sounds ludicrous to hear that. And yet that's kind of what modern science would really lead you to think, you know, that you love and other emotions just involve the limbic system and cortical functions and interactions within the brain and the head. And whereas that's completely out of touch, I think, with language and how people intuitively experience themselves. So I think it's been a misfortune in science that that dogma has been ensconced in stone for the most of the past century. But we see even in science now, like the materialist philosophy is now, like, it's not even valid anymore within science itself.
Yeah.
Because of kind of information processing views and the new physics, and like we see the materialist perspective, it was incredibly naive, thinking that everything could be explained in terms of individual particles or elements bouncing around in empty space and influencing each other. Like, that is like so superficial in light of new scientific development. And reality just gets more and more complex in physics. They find these ever deeper levels of complexity. And one physicist says, like, who knows where it could end? Like, you know, there's like one level of another. You peel away one layer off the onion, and there's, you know, more and more levels beyond that. So anyway, we've been talking about like the near-death experiences and the subjects now, I think, for the last 3 weeks, kind of focusing on this area, and it really brings up such important issues, because it would be a whole new science of man or human beings that if these kind of perspectives were recognized and explored, it would be such a fundamental shift, but I don't see that as happening within science, even though there's people on the borders of science who kind of look at the alternatives a bit more broadly. So anyway, well, I'll finish up that book. I have been enjoying it. It's nicely written. The book Jim and I have been talking about was Consciousness Beyond the Body by Pim van Lommel, a Dutch cardiologist. And I guess we've been studying the paranormal phenomena for 40 years. Both of us have, Jim. So it's interesting to see, I think, a resurgence of interest in near-death experience in the last few years again. I think it became very popular in the mid-70s with Raymond Moody's book, but then it kind of passed out of public attention for a while, but I think it's re-emerging lately. There seems to be a renewed interest and more publications on the issues. Jim, are you there?
Oh yeah, I'm here. Sorry, I thought you were going to add something, but you know, just to go back just one more time to this thing, like when Gurdjieff talked about, I realized one thing I didn't say about how people want to study consciousness where it doesn't exist. It's like in the conventional wisdom and psychology and philosophy, people tend to equate consciousness with the psychic functions, and as Uspensky explains it, consciousness is not the psychic functions. It's not reducible to the psychic functions. And like, typically, if you read an article, it's extraordinary how, as you alluded to earlier, that there really hasn't been much change in the last 40 or 50 or 75 or 100 years in terms of how people discuss consciousness in the psychological literature. And they begin with sort of the William James perspective by consciousness. I mean, states of consciousness, and they liken it to a stream in which people have thoughts and feelings and fantasies and daydreams and sensations. And, you know, everything that's in this stream of experience, which is an interesting way to think of it, certainly, you know, valuable thing, but people want to reduce consciousness. That's what they think consciousness is. It's the psychic functions and the psychological functioning. And yet, from the mystical perspective, that completely misses the point. You're mistaking the outcome or the manifestation from that which is deeper and which informs it and which is related to it as sort of a, as Uspensky says, you know, you can be more or less conscious, which means throwing more or less light on your psychic functioning, but it's not, you can't reduce consciousness to the psychic functions. So that's another aspect of it. And that's in keeping with the talk about the near-death experience. That's what's so interesting, is that with the stopping of the heart, and with the, you know, the cessation of brain activity, people still have this stream of experience, but the quality of it tends to change quite dramatically, and they have sort of these often these transcendent experiences and these realizations of higher truths and perceptions on higher planes of reality, which are in some ways consistent with the experience, their experiences in life, but in many ways involve sort of dramatic departures in terms of the content. People kind of see through things and see the bigger picture of things and have a much more profound understanding of themselves and of life and of the nature of reality. And in the terms we've been talking about, I think this is more that people pass into more into their hearts and out of their heads. I think they even though not their physical hearts, like into the they're somehow there's a qualitative change in their consciousness, which seems to be a departure from just simply thinking and reasoning and trying to abstract about things, and they have more sort of a direct intuitive perception of things, which is every bit as real, in fact, more real than that which characterizes our experience in the normal waking state. And so I don't know where I was going with that, but it shows that when we look at our psychological functions, we can't understand consciousness by trying to reduce everything to our psychological functions. Consciousness is something apart from, separate from the psychological functions. And it's amazing how in most Western psychological theorizing about consciousness, there's never any realization of that perspective. There's never any acknowledgement of that perspective. So certainly nobody, yeah. Nobody embraces it, I can tell you that. And there's this same logical dead end, I think, is doesn't make any sense. And that's where I just don't understand how anybody can assert that there's interest in the study of consciousness, a Western scientist, and not have an understanding and a familiarity and a hands-on experience with the mystical and esoteric tradition, because it's just it's so much more developed and so much richer, complex, and challenging than anything in Western psychology.
Even though it's difficult to weed through it all too, and
yeah, well, there is that. yeah,
and that's the other whole issue. But
I was going to just say that's why I think the Gurdjieff teaching is so, like, as we were both psychology students, is so perfect for Westerners, because it in a sense it and also for people who are intellectually oriented, because you don't have to go into a cloistered community. You don't have to retreat from life. This is something you can do as you go about your life. You can apply this system, and it's a system which has been translated into terms that are easier to deal with for Westerners, and for those even educated in Western psychology and philosophy, it's much more approachable, I think, than even some of the very profound mystical and esoteric teachings. I just don't think they're as practically oriented, a lot of them, as Gurdjieff's teaching is.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's a much more systematic and comprehensive psychology. Jim, at the onset, I've asked Don, I said we might take a break halfway through today's show. In a minute we'll take that break, and then when we come back, maybe we'll pick up on the slugs, and we'll just kind of shift over and we'll talk a little bit about Gurdjieff's view on the causes of war.
Okay.
And kind of shift focus a bit. So song is called Sacred Land, and it's by a native Canadian, Robin, from out in Saskatchewan. And we'll see. Anytime, Don, if you're here, we could might hear that song, and we'll take a few minutes.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. And then the white man came, he brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought the gun. They took away our land, they put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation, changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. He brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Someday is what he said, the nations they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.
Yeah, welcome back. Thank you, Rob, and a very beautiful piece of music. Okay, Jim, so in the second half, we were going to discuss Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is Gurdjieff's masterpiece book. And this is really one of the most complex occult classics of the past century. It's a very difficult and really quite bizarre book. It's about 1,200 pages long. It's in three books. And what it depicts in the story, Beelzebub is traveling on a spaceship with his grandson, Hasim. And Beelzebub is using the time as they're traveling to educate his grandson. So he tells him these different stories of things he witnessed and which occurred to him while he had been banished to our solar system. And apparently Beelzebub had set up an observatory on the planet Mars, and he visited the Earth on 6 occasions. And he would come down on a spaceship, which was called the Occasion. So he visited the Earth at the first time at the period of Atlantis, and the last visit was in the period of the, like Gurdjieff's own period, where he visits America and France and Russia. So he has these different visits to the planet Earth at different points through human history. And Gurdjieff maintains that at one point in early history, a comet collided with the Earth and broke off the moon and a second moon, which he says we're not aware of. And that when these fragments broke off, this caused major kind of catastrophe on the Earth. And then there were subsequent catastrophes when the moon, before it settled into orbit, and when it settled into orbit, it caused further displacement. So Gurdjieff has this kind of history of the solar system. And he says at one point when the moons broke off, there was a special commission of angels who had to kind of deal with this, maintaining the harmony of the solar system, and they had to make adjustments. And they made it so that when organic life arose on Earth, when any organic life living being dies, a certain energy is said to feed the moon. So the life and death of beings on planet Earth, according to Gurdjieff, feed the moon, and this helps to maintain the moon's harmony of the solar system. So it's a kind of odd story, a little bit about some of the history of what happened to the Earth. And when Beelzebub is observing the Earth, he has what he calls a tescueno, which is another word for telescope. And he has a tescueno on the planet Mars, and he observes the planet Earth. And over the century, he becomes intrigued by the phenomena of war, or what he calls the processes of reciprocal self-destruction, where people, you know, groups of people get out and they each go out and murder each other. And Beelzebub describes how there's this red stain, a blood stain through human history of all these wars and conflicts. And he says this is phenomenally strange. At one point, Beelzebub says, it was possible sometimes to observe very strange manifestations of theirs. That is, from time to time, they did something which was never done by three-brained beings on other planets. Namely, they would suddenly, without rhyme or reason, begin destroying one another's existence. From this horrible process of theirs, their influences rapidly diminished. And so Beelzebub became interested in how is it that the psyche of the human beings on planet Earth is so pathologically disturbed that they continually engage in these processes of reciprocal self-destruction. And that's one of the themes of Beelzebub's tale. And there are other themes to the book as well. Gurdjieff offers explanations of what he calls the fundamental cosmic laws, which are the laws of Triamazikamno and Hefnaparaparshino, which is the laws of 3 and 7. And he has a whole alternate kind of cosmic scheme, how these two sacred laws maintain what he calls the trogo-auto-egocratic process, whereby everything eats and everything is eaten, meaning that everything feeds off some things and everything in time feeds something else. He also talks about what it means to attain, for a human being to attain their soul. because Beelzebub explains that we have these higher being bodies, what he calls the Kesjan body and the mental body, but we have to form these or crystallize these. So in a way, we have to attain our soul. So Beelzebub is this kind of esoteric psychology about the nature of the soul. It's a fascinating book. If you learn when you read the book, I think the first time I read through it, I would have had to say, "What was that? Like, what did I just read?" Because it's so mind-boggling. At times, Gurdjieff will have one paragraph that runs like a whole page with so many indentations and such. I remember trying to figure out, is that a complete thought? And you'd have to kind of study. You know, it's not a book you can just read through. You have to study it, and over the years, as I've read it more different times, every time you read it, you understand it more deeply and find new gems of wisdom in it. Anything, Jim, you'd like to share just as a background and kind of orientation to the tales before we actually go into some of Gurdjieff's views on war?
Well, just that, as you say, it's not an easy book. It's not meant to be a straight exposition of his ideas. If you want to read an exposition of Gurdjieff's ideas, it's more readily digestible and apparently coherent. Just read his speeches in Search of the Miraculous that Uspensky quotes at Reports, which are phenomenal piece of journalism and are phenomenal lectures on the nature of his teaching. But the book is an allegory, and it's told in a certain way. Like, I mean, I've said this before, but and I think this is, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but I think that the speeches in Search of the Miraculous and another collection of Gurdjieff's talks, Views from the Real World, they're meant to appeal more to your intellect. They're coherent, they're incredibly elegant and sophisticated and because the ideas are unfamiliar, but they are told in a straightforward manner.
You seem to be breaking up a bit on the phone, Jim.
You're not hearing that?
No, well, you're breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure why.
Okay, I'm going to switch to another phone. So, what I was saying is I think in terms of Beelzebub, that what he's doing in that book is he's appealing more to, if in Search of the Miraculous, he's addressing consciousness more directly, and I think in Beelzebub, he's addressing conscience more in terms of what he's trying to create a very special feeling. He's trying to get the reader to experience certain degrees of tension, and he's purposely made this book very difficult to read in places. Although it's such an incredible piece of writing, because after you get used to it, the first 50 or 60 or 100 pages, you start to understand his very peculiar rhythm. But he's making you work all the time because he's trying to create a distance between you and these people that he's describing, human beings. So he's trying to impart to you an extraterrestrial perspective on what human beings are. So he's trying to break down all our associations with everything. So that's why he calls a telescope a Tescuano. He has all sorts of neologisms for all sorts of different things, because he wants you to even experience things that you already know what they are. He wants you to experience them in a somewhat displaced and distant way, so that they seem kind of strange. And he creates this incredible feeling throughout the whole book by doing that. And then that sort of sets things up for him to, when he's describing serious topics like the nature of war, he's trying to show people, like, this is really bizarre, like, that human beings do this. I mean, we just sort of accept it as part of our history that, you know, from time to time we go out and kill one another and do it for God and country and the good old USA or the good old Canada, whatever, and it's all okay. And he's saying, no, it's not okay. It's downright peculiar, and it says something about the nature of the human psyche and how we delude ourselves about who we are and what we are. So it's in a sense, it's long before a lot of the experimental writing that sort of defined 20th century literature to exist, that Gurdjieff was doing it. And he very clearly is capable of writing books that are more conventional, because he did that with Meetings with Remarkable Men, which was the next book in his three-part series. So there's definitely method in his madness, and it's meant to bewilder and baffle you and upset you and cause you to examine and re-examine everything that you take to be your knowledge. And as he says, I think, in the introduction, to destroy without mercy to corrode without mercy all of the rubbish accumulated in human mentation.
And yeah, through the centuries,
and he succeeds to do in doing it. And as you say, the first time you read it, you kind of think, "Well, what the hell was that?" Because it's an incredible book. But even there are moments in it when the first time I read it, it was just so incredibly brilliant in parts, and so incredibly strange in other parts. It was like, I have no idea what this is about, but yeah.
Well, we'll give a sample. It would be good to get through a few readings. When you were talking about how he gets you to see things in an unfamiliar or familiar things in an alternate kind of perspective, I think one of the best examples of that is what led to his sixth visit to the planet Earth was that he was observing through his telescope, and the human beings had invented something whereby someone over here could do a something little thing with their thumb, and the man over there would fall down dead or mutilated. So what he was depicting was the invention of firearms. But it kind of made you realize how absurd it is, kind of, that a man over here does a little thing with his thumb, and that guy falls down dead. So, and it kind of gets you to see it from an alien perspective. And he's often talking. Here's another quote. This is I'm going to read this quote. Give a first sample of Beelzebub's the quality of the writing. He says the beings of that contemporary community have been the benefactors of the other contemporary beings of your planet, offering them, as they say, their philanthropic aid, especially as regards their first being duty, namely the duty of carrying out from time to time the process of reciprocal self-destruction. Thanks to them, the discharge of that being duty of theirs has gradually become, for your contemporary favorites, the merest trifle. In the absence of those inventions, it used to be exceedingly arduous for these poor favorites of yours to fulfill that being duty, because they were formerly forced to spend a great deal of sweat for it. But thanks to the adaption of every kind invented by these contemporary beings, it is now, as again our esteemed Mullah Nasr al-Din says, just roses, roses. The contemporary beings now scarcely need to make any effort whatsoever in order to destroy completely the existence of beings like themselves. Sometimes, sitting quietly in what they call their smoking rooms, they can destroy, just as a pastime, as it were, 10 and sometimes even hundreds of others like themselves. That's so funny. That's a funny passage, AJ. I read that and I think of what we have now, especially with all this new drone technology.
Yeah.
You have people in Florida, and you have these bases where people kind of sit and they have their joysticks, and they have all these kind of computer game skills, but they're kind of murdering real people with it.
Yeah.
And it's become like the merest trifle. It's like it's so far removed from the reality of what is being done. Anyway, so that was one quote from Gurdjieff. I thought also I'd try to go into a little bit of what Gurdjieff says about, like, power-possessing beings. And one of at one point, his grandson comes to him and says, "Grandfather, why don't these beings realize how horrific these processes are and do anything to stop it or prevent it?" And then Beelzebub, he kind of answers that question by telling this very peculiar kind of story. Okay. He says, "I must tell you that thanks to the abnormally established conditions of being existence there, the waking psyche, as it is expressed there, of each one of them gradually becomes, from the very beginning of responsible existence, such that he can think sincerely and see things in the true light exclusively only if his stomach is so full of the first being food that it is impossible for what are called the wandering nerves in it to move, or, as they themselves say, he is stuffed quite full. And besides, all his needs already inherent in him, which are unbecoming to three-brained beings, and which had become the dominant factors for the whole of his presence, are fully satisfied, of course, only for that given moment. When these three-brained beings of your planet, particularly of the present time, who have the means of gorging to satiety and of fully satisfying all their other needs, and who perhaps could do something for the struggle against this phenomenal evil prevailing on their planet, are satiated, and their mentioned needs are satisfied, and they are seated on what are called their soft English divans, in order, as it is said there, to digest it all, they do not profit, even during this time so suitable for sincere thinking, but indulge instead in the maleficent self-calming. For instance, when, after gorging and satisfying themselves, these important and power-possessing beings of the earth are seated on their said divans, the associative thoughts, which ought inevitably to flow in them, receives shocks from the reflexes of their stomach and sex organs and wander freely in all directions, as they say there, to their heart's content, and so pleasantly free and easy, as if they, that is, these thoughts of theirs, were strolling of an evening in Paris along the Boulevard de Capucines. When these power-possessing beings of your planet are seated on their soft divan, subjects like the following think in them. For instance, how to get his revenge on that acquaintance of his, John Smith, who a few days before looked at a woman he liked not with his right eye, but with his left. Or this digesting terrestrial power-possessing or important being thinks, "Why did not my horse come in first yesterday at the races as I expected, but some other?" Or, "Why do those stocks, which are in fact quite worthless, go up every day on the market higher and higher?" Or, finally, he thinks something of this kind: "If I were in John Smith's shoes, who invented the new method of breeding flies for making ivory from their skeletons, then from the profits obtained, I would do this, that, and the other, and not as that fool who, like a dog in the manger, will neither himself eat nor let others eat," and so on in the same vein. Still, it does occasionally happen there that some power-possessing being or important being of the earth suddenly chances to think not under the influences of the reflexes of his stomach and sex organs, but thinks sincerely and quite seriously about these or other questions with particular regard to this terrifying terrestrial question. Like, that's a very... It's an odd piece. It's such a what he's doing is he's kind of depicting, you know, these power-possessing and important beings. They're just like the same as everybody else, the same state of unconsciousness, of being controlled by their, you know, their wandering nerves of the stomach. They have to be stuffed quite full, and their wandering sex impulses, and their desire all the time for making money on the stock exchange. So partly his answer is why can't human beings eradicate war? He's kind of showing us the psychopathology of the power-possessing beings. Like, that's what he's depicting, and what their motives really are. And in a way, what he will come to this, he talks about the League of Nations and how some of these people tried to form the League of Nations to eradicate war. I'll move on and just try to, I forget what I was going to say. I'll keep reading. I'll give a few more examples. No sooner do the stomachs of these sincere, agitated beings become empty, or no sooner do they recover a little from these extreme, externally arisen impressions which had dejected them, than they not only instantly forget their vow to eradicate war, but even themselves again begin consciously and unconsciously to do precisely everything which is, in general, is the cause of the outbreak of these phenomena, of these processes between communities. Such a monstrous need arises in their abnormal psyche because they expect certain egoistic profits from these processes. And with their degenerative mentation, they even hope that the greater the scale of the next process, the greater the extent of the said profits to be obtained, either personally for themselves or for their nearest. It even happens there, my boy, that certain of the power-possessing and important beings among your favorites unite and form a special society with the aim of jointly finding out and actualizing in practice some possible means for the abolition of this arch-criminal property of theirs. But owing to their various personal, egoistic, and vainglorious aims, the ordinary terrestrial, important, and power-possessing beings who had then assembled very soon quarreled among themselves and went their ways home without accomplishing anything. Sorry, I skipped that because I skipped some of my explanatory text, so it didn't flow as easily. Okay, but this is another interesting section. In the course of observation during my last sojourn there, I cleared up, among other things, that the beings with objective reason do not happen to be in these societies for the following reasons. The point is that in order to participate in any society whatsoever, a being must always of necessity be important. And such a being there among them, thanks once again to the abnormally established conditions of being existence, can only be one who either has a great deal of money or who becomes what is called famous among the other beings there. And since, especially during recent times, only those beings can become famous and important among them in whom the sacred function, namely being conscience, is entirely absent, then in consequence of the fact that this sacred function in the presences of beings is in general always associated with everything that represents and is objective reason, then of course those three-brained beings with objective reason always have conscience as well. And consequently, such a being with conscience will never be important among the other beings. That is why the beings with pure reason there never have had and never will have the possibility of taking part in the societies of beings who are formed of important and power-possessing beings. I'll stop there for a minute. I think that's a really very brilliant passage, and I think that's so relevant to what we see in the world today with all these different, like we do have all these important power-possessing beings, and they have all these kind of societies of theirs from the UN, and, you know, when has the UN ever done anything to stop a war, bring about peace? And all these other secret societies. Has it?
Sure.
Well, I mean, is it just okay, the war in Libya?
I'm just saying it's not. You know, it has. There has been times, but I mean, I think the more basic point is you have to remember. Well, two things. One is what he's saying is that these people, just because they're running things and they have power, doesn't mean that they have any level of consciousness or conscience above that of anybody else. Like, they're governed by their lower chakras, by their sex drives and their food drives, and, you know, they want, like, their stomach's got to be full, and they're wandering sexual ideas and stuff. It's just, they're just like everybody else, and you know, they don't have any objective reason. That's the whole point. This is all egoistic, and all that, even when they're well-intentioned, it's not going to lead to anything. I mean, you have to remember Gurdjieff was writing this right after the peace to end the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, you know, in 1919, when the leaders of the victorious powers got together and decided they're going to, you know, fix everything and punish Germany and create the League of Nations to ensure peace, and it all completely, you know, it didn't last. It only lasted 20 years, and they were back at war again, 100 times worse than the first one, you know, and that's the whole point. It's like anybody who thinks that, like Henry Miller said, you know, in his famous anti-war essay, there isn't a leader in the world who can see beyond the end of his nose. He said that at the end of the Second World War, you know, when there was going to be more peace, and it just leads to the same thing over and over again because these people aren't conscious. That they're just egoistically driven sleepwalkers like everybody else.
Yeah, that's what, here's another example. Okay, so here he's referring to the meetings of the League of Nations, and Beelzebub predicts that nothing effective will come out of it. And instead, he suggests that the members of the society, and then the quote begins here, will achieve personally for themselves by this new contrivance of theirs one most formidable and most useful result. Namely, thanks to this official society of theirs, they will have still another, as it is said, very plausible excuse for drawing wool over the eyes of their what are called proprietesses, who are, for these terrestrial contemporary power-possessing beings, either their wife, mistress, mother-in-law, or finally the assistant in some large store, and so on. Whereupon, thanks to this new official societies of theirs, they will have the opportunity of passing the time tranquilly among their friends, important and power-possessing beings like themselves, and that these official 5 o'clocks, which without doubt will be very often arranged ostensibly for affairs connected, as it were, with the aims of this important official society of theirs, they will be able to pass the time without the silent, though terrifying, glances and watchfulness on the part of their proprietresses. It's so funny in a way because it reminds me so much. No, I think when these people like you get all these guys, they go out to Bohemian Grove, eh? Like the presidents and the Hollywood people and all these people go on, they, you know, they bust in homosexual prostitutes and they have the female prostitutes in the local villages and they run around with no clothes on and pee on trees. It's like they're all escaping their proprietresses, you know, and you see similar things like in other secret societies. I think that's partly when the Bilderbergs meet and other groups like that. So much of it, you know, the prostitution is very much a part of this, the providing these men with opportunities to escape from their proprietresses. I think it's really quite a profound kind of truth to this.
I don't see it even like that. I just see it as like, you know, it's they form these organizations that have these highfalutin ideals that are supposed to end war, and basically it's an excuse for these guys to get out of the house and bang their mistresses, you know, or their prostitutes or whatever. It's like, you know, it's the contrast between the supposedly high idealistic purposes of the organization and the petty egoistic, you know, semi-perverse pleasures of the individuals who are involved, you know, like whether or not that's going to a prostitute in Manhattan or you know, like Bohemian Grove. It's like, you know, that's the way I see it. It's just like, you know, who are these guys trying to kid, you know? Like, I mean, they don't have like the objective reason to achieve anything, so it's all kind of a sham. It's a scam.
Yeah,
a high, you know, but always couched in very, you know, noble ideals and sentiments. That's the tragedy of it all. It's like, oh, why doesn't anybody ever do anything about it? Well, they do. You know, they form these organizations and they study things and they propose solutions. But at the end of the day, nobody's really serious about it because they still got their eye on the stock ticker and, you know, and lunch and their sexual needs. You know, they're not very elevated beings.
No, we don't have objective reason and conscience.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier like that is one of the most important themes in Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. It's like the only thing that can save humankind is the awakening of conscience.
Yeah.
And he tells a story about how the early sacred messengers, they came and they tried to teach people concerning the first three sacred being impulses of faith, hope, and love. But then Beelzebub says that the human psyche became so degenerate that they didn't know what, they couldn't effectively use faith, hope, and love now because those were so distorted, what those had become. And so the remaining way of changing humankind was through the remorse of conscience. So that plays a huge role the remorse of conscience is very important for Gurdjieff in this book. He even says the one law of morality, which he traces back to initiates in Atlantis, was that something is morally bad if it depends on your conscience. That's you judge the objective morality of something by whether it affects your conscience. Anyway, so he goes on. I'll read a little bit more. Continue on with some more reading here. And this is what he starts talking about initiates, and he talks about there are initiates for these special societies. And he's saying how the meaning of the word initiate has become degenerated over time. He says, those beings call each other by this name who belong to those what are called their criminal gangs, which in the said period have greatly multiplied there, and whose members have as their chief aim to steal from those around them only essence values. Under the pretense of following supernatural or mystic scientists, these criminal gangs there are really occupied and very successful with this kind of plunder. And so any and every genuine member of such a gang there is called an initiate. There are even great initiates among these terrestrial initiates, and these great initiates, especially at the present time, are made out of those ordinary initiates of new formation who in their virtuoso affairs pass, as is said there, through fire, water, copper pipes, and even through all the roulette wheels of Monte Carlo. Roulette halls of Monte Carlo. That's a very odd passage there, Jim. I don't know if you read that, how I interpret that. But just to go back, he says that through in their virtuoso affairs, as it is said there, they pass through fire, water, copper pipes, and even through all the roulette halls of Monte Carlo. Do you have any associations to that or references to that, Jim?
Well, I mean, the fire and water starts out as if, you know, like a mystical initiation or like an alchemical initiation, but I don't understand that it sounds like that the all the roulette halls of Monte Carlo is like a degeneration, a deviated octave of some sort of process or some sort of path. Is that how you kind of, I don't understand the copper pipes.
Well, here's what I wrote in the slug. Beelzebub's final cryptic references, to their virtuoso affairs of the great initiates and the roulette halls of Monte Carlo would seem to be in reference to the Rothschild dynasty of European bankers, infamous for just such affairs, for owning many such halls, and for concocting innumerable wars and rebellions while deceiving the population through their own media and propaganda. So what I related to, I thought the roulette wheels of Monte Carlo, like I thought like that is signifying like these top European bankers and, known for their, like it's claimed, you know, these elites are alleged to have, you know, major kind of pornographic parties and some of them are known for that. That's in some of the traditions. So I thought that was in reference to, you know, what people would call the Rothschilds own most of Monte Carlo. And also the fire, water, copper pipes. Fire, water is like the Rothschild shield is the symbols of fire and water, which is the Star of David. So I didn't know if that was a reference to the fire, water, copper pipes. I didn't know if that might be connected to the... I took that as a reference, an oblique reference to the Rothschilds. That's how I took that. And I need to investigate it a little bit more. But Monte Carlo's in France, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a big...
It's
I mean,
French
I...
French Riviera, isn't it? I think it's the French Riviera, right?
Yeah, which is kind of one of the places in the world which was most housed the kind of opulent elites.
Oh, it's the playground of the rich, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay, so now I'll go on a little bit more and maybe come up with another... What else do we got here? Well, the one of the main points in Beelzebub's tales is Gurdjieff talks about the role of hustamus individuals in fomenting wars, and he defines a hustamus, which is like an invented, one of his invented words, like a neologism, and I don't really understand the root of the word. It's H-A-S-S. Hasna, N-A-M, Hasnamas, A-S-S, Hasnamas. Jim, you pronounced it has no mass, which is very interesting.
That's what I sort of see it as being in a way, is like that they have no substance, you know, It could be like he does a lot of play on words like that, you know. That
yeah, and it makes sense because he often refers to them as terrestrial nullities. Is one
yeah.
of his
yeah.
odd. Yeah. So the idea is they have no mass, and he has this list of seven being impulses, characteristics of hasnamasas. And in modern terminology, I think a hasnamas is closest to what we would call a psychopath. Like a psychopath is an individual who doesn't have empathy or feeling for other people. So a psychopath will always use people and don't experience remorse or guilt over things that other people would experience remorse or guilt over. So they're users of people. Lack compassion, they're predatorial in relationships.
What do they lack?
Sorry?
What do they lack? They have no conscience.
Yeah, they lack conscience. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's like the defining feature of a psychopath.
Yeah.
What was Robert Hare's most recent book? He's a famous Canadian
yeah.
psychologist who did the studied psychopaths. His last book was called Without Conscience, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Without Conscience, and it was all about the psychopaths, how they lack conscience. Well, for Gurdjieff, he calls them hasnamasas, and their main feature is that they lack the sacred being impulse of objective conscience, because Gurdjieff sees a conscience in the person is a representative of divinity. Like that, it's because we have a spiritual nature that we have the faculty of conscience. So it's regarded as a sacred being impulse. But the hasnamas, they're controlled by seven other being impulses, and these are the Gurdjieff's listing. Their impulses first is towards every kind of depravity, conscious as well as unconscious. Number two, the feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray. That's like deceiving people, manipulating them. The irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. Interesting. Inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. Like, we have to wonder, like, who are these people in our society who would gladly initiate wars if they can make monies off it and extend their power? It's like these people, it means nothing to them to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. You know, if we can invade Iraq and use shock and awe and kind of destroy the country and murder millions of people and make fortunes for these investors into the military-industrial complex. And it's like these people, that's legitimate. That's legitimate in their business world mentality. And they have no kind of feeling against destroying the existence of other breathing creatures. Okay, number four, the urge to become free from the necessity of actualizing the being efforts demanded by nature. So it's like they don't actualize the being efforts demanded by nature. It's like being pampered all your life, so you never have to actualize. You don't develop will. Instead, you're pampered. Number five, the attempt by every kind of artificiality to conceal from others what, in their opinions, are one's physical defects. It's like vanity number six, the calm self-contentment in the use of what is not personally deserved. And number seven, the striving to be not what one is. And it's an interesting list of impulses, and through his tale, Beelzebub illustrates these different impulses and different stories he tells. Okay, I know, Jim, we're coming down. It's we got just 5 minutes or so left. I won't try to get through too much more. It's so hard even to give a sense of Gurdjieff's writing and Beelzebub's. It's such a complex book. It just, you know, it's something that has to be approached oneself. And I think The Slugs is an excellent introduction to the book. I think it would make the Beelzebub's tales far more accessible to people in the way it's a primer a bit. I think it captures the essential themes and teachings of the book. Yeah, but you have to do a lot of distilling in the book to arrive, like I've distilled it a lot to arrive at the formulation of The Slugs. I think when I've studied this book now for almost 40 years, and when I first studied it, I was mainly interested in the psychology of the soul and that aspect of this book. And it's only in the last 5-6 years that I became more aware of what's happening on the world scene. And when I did that, I realized so much more about how, in a way, Beelzebub's Tales is one of the most profound anti-war documents ever penned by a human being. And it explains, in a way, it explains the causes of war by depicting the low-level mentality of human beings, how we became so degenerate and formed what Gurdjieff calls a false consciousness system. It's a remarkable book, and at one point in the book, Gurdjieff is talking about the future, and he seemed to have a bleak view in ways of the future, of really changing this pattern of warfare through human history. And he makes a comment that the only thing that would ever save them is the teaching of a being with a very advanced level of objective reason. And I think in Beelzebub's tales, that's what Beelzebub represents, is a being who's obtained this higher level of objective reason. And he's looking impartially at an impartial criticism of the life of humanity. And that's what the tales are about. And you can't read them, but you have to laugh at human culture and society and ourselves when you read the tales, because it's almost surrealistic. It's like a Monty Python book almost at times. His stories are so bizarre and such unusual elements in them. Anyway, before we've got a few minutes left, Jim, any fairly brief last words, Jim, on Beelzebub?
Read it. Yeah, no, I think you're, I think you're, like you said, your book is a good primer on it, because you need a bit of a guide to really navigate the book, and it's good because The Slugs is a very good book, because there's very little out there about Beelzebub, and it's a very good commentary on the major themes in the book. It's very worthwhile reading, and actually probably would help people a lot to read the book and understand it.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, I would encourage listeners, please visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. I think the CA suffix is it represents Canada. So, and it's just spelled out Zeropoint .ca. And I have a book sale there. I have a copy of all of my books, all personally signed and mailed anywhere in North America for $100. So that's a fairly good deal on my books. And if anyone would like to take up some serious scholarly esoteric studies. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thanks, Chris. It was fun.
Interesting show. I'll finish up that book on near-death experiences for next time.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Be very interested to talk more about it.
Oh, I also want to share some of what I've been reading. Wow, what a wild book. Conspiracy of the Six-Pointed Star by Tex Mars. What a shocking book. I'll share some of that next week.
Okay.
Okay, so thank you, BBS. Thanks, Don, and Doug, and Seth, and thank you all, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, Jim. We'll see you in 2 weeks, too. And everybody, you got to try to remember yourself, to make the effort to wake up and be more conscious as you go around your life. Okay, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, all.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye.